Welcome back, Stephen De Silva. Another time. It's always great fun, and you get a lot out of our chats and conversations, and I know our listeners appreciate them. We're going to talk today about something which is sort of, in a way, it sounds a bit pedestrian, not just because we're going to be walking through the cathedral, but most of us go into churches without really remembering, because we're not medieval anymore, so we don't have that much sort of fear of the place. And we go in there and we think, well, this is an impressive building. We don't really quite understand the layout of it. In St. Albans' case, we tend to go in through what looks like a brand new end. That's the West End.
Because it's at the western end of the building. Yeah. And it is very cleaned. And it is quite new, you know. It's 1870s. In St. Albans, that's new. But yes, that's the western end of the building. Or not quite, put it that way. Churches were built traditionally on a west-east axis, facing east. So the further you got within the building, the more eastward you were going. And this was connected with the idea of the sun and the brightness and the rising, just traditional ways, I suppose, of looking at symbols of God and symbols of his light.
Light was important in buildings that...
You needed the light, of course, so you wanted that light blazing through the east window to illuminate your early morning mass or whatever else it might be. And then, of course, the light turned around in the afternoons. You got this glorious light through the western window. And so that's why often in some of these very big churches in England, the west and east windows are the most large and elaborate, and in St. Albans it's actually the west window that's beautiful and elaborate, that glorious First World War memorial window that we have.
There's a main door in the middle of the west end, and there are two side doors.
The two side doors are extras. If you go back to the pre-1870s entry, there was one large entry into the building at the western end. We still have those doors. They're actually within the cathedral now. We have them on display, and you entered in through that main entrance. When Lord Grimthorpe enhanced the building, he created the two side doors, which allow entry into the side aisles that run along the side of the great nave of the building.
Was he responsible for that? You have to step up to get into the nave. It can't always have been like that.
He did re-level the floor. The floor at one time actually tilted. The floor had probably naturally risen over the centuries anyway. So he did do a lot of realignment, created those steps up into the nave itself.
Right. Now, what does a nave mean? Why is it called a nave?
Why is it a nave? People often ask that, and people will inaccurately say it's where the knaves, the common people, sat. It isn't, no. It comes from the word navis, Latin for a ship, and that was a symbol of the church. So sometimes you will still see in church windows a little boat being tossed around on the sea. The idea was that one travelled in this little boat. This was your journey through life. And so everyone gathered together to travel in the nave, in the boat, towards heaven. That's the symbolic concept that people had in their minds. So it actually comes from the word for ship or boat.
I never knew that.
There we go.
And of course, the nave points down towards...
The nave is usually a large open space, which in the earliest days of these big churches had both religious and secular functions. So the nave would be a place where you might go and sign a legal deal between you and your neighbour if you were selling property, because if you witnessed it in the house of God within the nave, that would be a reason why you would not renege or have done a bad deal, because God was witnessing. So the nave had a secular function as well. In St. Albans Abbey, St. Albans Abbey as it was, cathedral now, the nave was really also a pilgrim area. You have to remember the monks worshipped towards the eastern end of the church. So the nave was the area where pilgrims gathered, went to mass at one of the little side altars, perhaps, which no longer exist in the nave, and then would have actually left the nave and left the building and been readmitted to the shrine of St. Albans further up. They wouldn't have walked through all the wonderful choir stalls and things you can see. That was for the monks only.
Would there have been confessional boxes and so on down the sides? Or
probably not, because that's a much later idea. Right. Priests would have heard confessions. What would have been down the sides would have been lots of, we believe, perhaps smaller little altars placed at the bases of the pillars. Because if you were a priest monk, you probably wanted somewhere to say a daily mass. Pilgrims would be arriving at different times during the day. So perhaps when you turned up as a pilgrim at one of these little side altars, like you see in a big Roman Catholic cathedral today, there'd be a mass going on and you'd gather around that one, and then there'd be another mass in an hour's time at another one. We think that may be one way that these little altars were being used.
Go back to the nave.
Yep.
Today there are lots of seats in there.
Yes.
Lots of people come in not only for the church services but also for concerts and, and all sorts of other things.
Yeah.
There weren't any seats then.
No, and of course that's the original expression of going to the wall. You know, the idea that somebody goes to the wall when they're in crisis. Well, old people were allowed to go to the wall of the nave and lean against the wall. or rest against the wall. There may even have been a little ledge there. There were no seats. You stood for these services. It would be very tiring, so a child or an old person could go to the wall and lean against it and rest during the Mass.
And then the great columns that hold the roof above it.
We call them piers, P-I-E-R-S. So imagine something holding a great object. The exterior walls of the nave had a lot of work done on them, but the piers, the columns, some of them are the original Norman ones, finished in 1115, some of them from the 1200s, and then there was a big collapse and a rebuild in the 1300s. So there are piers of all three of those ages within the nave.
And there are illustrations or remains of illustrations on some of them.
On the Norman ones, the ones from 1115, there are some wonderful wall paintings. That's because those are actually not made of stone. They're made of bricks and flint that were recycled from the Roman city. St. Albans Abbey was basically a recycled building. The Saxon and Norman abbots hauled huge quantities of Roman brick and rubble up the hill and made the building out of that. And because it was rubble, you couldn't carve it. So if you're going to decorate those piers, they had to be painted. That's why there is so much in the way of lovely geometric painting on the arches, but also paintings of the crucifixion and of saints on the actual piers themselves. Later on, when the abbots bought themselves a quarry, which they did up at Tottenham in the Dunstable Downs, the later piers are carved stone and more of what you see in most of the great churches in England.
And those paintings, or what I might call frescoes, are they of really religious scenes? I'm not sure.
Yes, if you look at them as they are now, under each one, under the arch side, there is a scene of the crucifixion, and below it, a scene from the life of the Virgin Mary. Because around about the time these are being painted, in the 1200s and 1300s, and some of them as late as the 1400s, there's a lot of interest in the role of the Virgin Mary in telling the story of how God comes to earth, and she accepts God's call to bear God's Son, and all the rest of it. So you have a crucifixion scene, you have a scene from the life of the Virgin, and then facing you, as you imagine walking down the nave, facing you are huge standing figures of significant saints. Christopher, Thomas Becket, the Lady in Black. We call her that because I've been a guide 40 years and she's changed her name four times in 40 years. She's either St. Zita, St. Cither, St. Christina, who knows. And then the last one, the one nearest the nave altar, is actually a painting of Alban and Amphibolus, the two original saints, and our founding story of how we got here.
In all the refurbishment, was there a temptation to repaint the originals? They're not in their full form, are they?
Of course, they were covered up with lime wash by the reformers, by the Puritan era reformers. And of course, that lime wash will have eaten away at the top colour coats. They were only uncovered in the 1850s and 60s. And bless them, the Victorians who uncovered them didn't really understand conservation the way we do now, so they were varnished. Varnish then, when it came away, probably took even more of the original details. They probably looked slightly better than they do now when they were originally uncovered. It's rather sad, but we have got this project to illuminate them in some of their original colours, at least parts of them.
Now, I call them frescoes, but I don't think that's right.
No, they're not really frescoes. Fresca is the Italian word fresh. A fresco is painted on fresh plaster. So imagine you have a fresh area of plaster and the artist sets to work and paints on that plaster quickly before it dries. Frescoes we associate with Italy, don't we, or Spain or Southern Europe. The trouble with plaster in damp old England is that it doesn't dry very quickly. And so what would have happened in a place like St. Albans would have been that if you'd painted onto wet plaster, the paint probably would have bled into the plaster before it finally dried. And we think that, well, we associate these with a particular painter, a chap called Walter of Colchester, who was painting at St. Albans in the early 1200s. Walter seems to have developed a very different approach. The plaster was put on, it was allowed to dry, so instead of being a fresco, it was a secco, a dry plaster, and you just wetted the bit you were painting and you painted that so that it dried much more quickly. You didn't have the whole depth of the plaster to dry, just the wet surface as you applied your paint. So they're actually seccos, not frescoes, which is a curious thing we try and tell our visitors about.
Do you know what was there?
Well, yes, there are traces of all kinds of colours on there. We know that some very beautiful things like red vermilion, all kinds of expensive gold leaf was used on these paintings. So we're going to illuminate them in almost three stages. Illuminate what you've got now so you can see it in more detail. Then illuminate what we can absolutely historically say was there. So much clearer outlines of the figures. You'll be able to see St. Christopher holding the Christ child in his arms much more clearly than you do now. And then the third stage of illumination will be an artist's reconstruction of what we believe their full glory looked like. And we know they were glorious because we're told that pilgrims came in, saw them and dropped to their knees because it was a vision of heaven. And that's what these churches were for a pilgrim.
Because if you stand in the nave and look up, there's something whose name has always confused me, and I'm going to pronounce it correctly, I think, the clear story, where there's light coming in.
Yes, there was. Nowadays, there are windows down at the first story level, but a lot of those are much later. The original ones would have been quite small windows, but because the lower wall was solid, the next story up you could put windows in and the wall didn't have to be quite so substantial. And I always thought this clerestory, or clerestory, sometimes people say that, I thought this was a very complicated word, and I went and looked it up 3 weeks ago, and it's Old English for the clear story, the story where the light clearly shone in. It's as basic as that.
And there's a walkway in front?
There are some walkways up there, up in the clerestories. In fact, the projectors, which are going to illuminate these paintings, are going to be fixed up in the clerestories.
Heading down the nave, ignoring the side aisles for the moment, we hit a screen.
Which has traditionally been called the rood screen. And you will hear lots of churches talk about their rood screens. Rood, R-O-O-D, is the Anglo-Saxon word for cross. And you would have probably had on this screen, which was halfway down the building, a large crucified figure of Christ on the cross at the top of that screen, perhaps with Mary and John either side of him. In other words, representing the description of the crucifixion in the Gospels. And so these screens were often called rood screens because the cross was the central feature. Almost all of those roods were cut down at the Reformation. In some parish churches in England, they've been put back by the Victorians. St. Albans has never restored its rood screen in that way. The actual screen is there. The cross hasn't been restored. What happened was later on, Canon Glossop bought a cross, a lovely crystal cross, and installed it on the rood screen, but it's at human eye level.
And that's what we call the nave screen, isn't
it? And I think in St. Albans, we prefer the title nave screen because it more clearly explains what it does. It separates the nave from the monks in their choir. So the nave screen is what we tend to call it. Some people still do call it the rood screen.
And is that part also of the process of keeping the people away from the Holy of Holies? That you can't see. There you are in the nave.
Yeah.
You've come all this way from wherever. You've walked and you're a pilgrim. And suddenly, you're excluded.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's why there was so much focus perhaps on the wall paintings and the nave. Because that would have been your focus as a pilgrim. But you're right. When you came into that building originally, you'd have come in and be able to look right up in the distance and see the shrine of St. Alban covered in glorious gold and gems. I've had different reasons suggested for that big, thick screen dividing the people from the monks. One suggestion says it's to do with the monks being afraid of pilgrims bringing the plague with them, because the time that that one is built, 1350, is when Britain is really experiencing the plague. I think it's much more practical than that. I think that the nave is busy, it's full of pilgrims, they're chattering, they're excited, but the monks have to get on with their prayers. They pray 8 times a day on the other side of that screen, and probably a good, solid, substantial screen helps create a more enclosed, private space for the monks to carry out their life of prayer. Because, of course, they saw themselves as praying not just for themselves, but praying for the whole world, because the world hasn't got time to pray. The world has got to be busy doing its business. So the monks are praying for you.
That was their raison d'être.
Absolutely. It's like a huge powerhouse of prayer, you know, emanating prayer out towards God. And so I think that big screen is also about giving the monks some privacy and some space.
Of course, that area, the other side of that screen, looks like choir stalls.
Yes.
And that's presumably what it's been used as many, many times over in the past. But it was originally the monks' prayer area.
In choir stalls, as you see now. So the ones that are there now were only 1903, but they copy what you would have seen with the monks. In other words, all the way along the back, there are little seats for the monks. And then further down towards the floor level, you've got a space for the choir to sing. There would have been monks singing, but there may also have been trained musicians that supplement the monastic choir. We know there was also a choir further down in the far east of the building as well, a separate choir there. So yes, you have the monks saying their prayers in that space, in those stalls.
And at the end of the choir stall, we're almost at the transept.
Yeah, so the transepts are the arms. Imagine a cross-shaped building. The transepts are the arms of that cross. We think that what happened was, coming back to the pilgrims again, they'd have been at a service in the nave, they'd have gone out a side door, and they were probably readmitted at the far end of the north transept, and they followed a pathway up to the shrine of St. Alban without disturbing the monks. They didn't cut through the monastic choir. They were readmitted.
Looking at it geographically, then we've got the nave takes takes up the bulk of the distance because that's longer than the the rest of the
area. It is, yeah. The longest nave in England.
And then they have the monks' primary study, prayer, chanting,
the choir,
music, the choir.
The choir.
Then you have the transept.
Yeah, and the area where it all intersects is called the crossing. We still talk today about gathering in the crossing, which is directly under the tower.
That has any particular function other than being a sort of gathering place? And
no, it just is a good place to meet. But beyond the crossing, looking up towards the next big screen, is an area called the presbytery. And a presbyter is just another word for priest. It was an exclusive area where priests gathered to hear the mass. So the high altar, the mass is at the great high altar of St. Albans, as opposed to the nave altar. Those would have been attended mostly by ordained people, monks or priests or whatever else. The presbytery.
Because nowadays you can walk around the southern side of the rood screen and the choir to get to the transept.
That's right. Crossing. Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't there originally.
Those aisles were there, but no admission to the public. In fact, that huge nave screen, that rood screen, the doors in it have door handles only on the monastic side. As a symbolic way of saying the monks can open those doors and come through to you. You cannot pass through that screen to them. The doors have no handles on the people's side.
And of course, on the people's side today is where all the church services, all the services take place, because there's an altar.
Yeah, they happen on both sides of that screen. But you're right, in the big nave area, that's where the really big services take place. That's where things like our main Sunday morning service at 9:30, the parish Eucharist, takes place. But there's another one that takes place on the other side later on at about 11 o'clock.
Staying with the line, which is, as you said, almost east-west.
Because of the way the hill lies in St. Albans, St. Albans Cathedral actually lies on a slightly northwest-southeast angle. It's not true east-west, but that's to do with the way the hillside lies. It would have been very difficult to excavate that hillside to force the building into absolute east-west alignment.
Heading east still, we come to the presbytery, which is the priest area.
Right behind the priest area, behind that big screen, is the Shrine of St. Alban. Also at the geographically highest point in the building. We've been thinking about length, but if you think about height, if you walk into St. Alban's, you're walking up a little bit each time, aren't you? When you come in the west door, you walk up some steps. Yeah. Then you walk up a few steps to the presbytery. Then you walk up a few steps more. The shrine is at the absolute highest point in the building, and you walk up a few steps to get to the Shrine of Alban. So, not surprisingly, symbolically, it was really important that the saint was enshrined at the high point of the building.
Does he lie feet towards the east?
In the Middle Ages, when you buried the people, they lay with their feet towards the east, so that when they rose up out of their graves on Judgment Day, they were facing God. You buried the clergy the other way around, because the clergy had to face their people, and the idea being that a clergyman must not mislead his people in any way. He was responsible for their salvation. So the idea would be that on Judgment Day, the people would face God and the priests would face their people and be accountable to them for their care. It's a lovely idea, isn't it? And we still do that today. In fact, when Archbishop Runcie was buried, he was buried in the traditional alignment with his feet lying towards the west.
So where have we got?
We've really got right up to the shrine, which would have been the high point of that building. And then beyond it today is a beautiful chapel called the Lady Chapel. And this always causes confusion as well, because people think it's to do with where the ladies sat. And you can understand why, because if you're a Muslim or a Jewish person, you probably know that if you're an Orthodox version of those religions, men and women do sit separately. We had a wonderful open evening, by the way, for lots of our Muslim neighbours and the Muslim community a few weeks ago from some of the mosques here in St. Albans. And they were fascinated by this, because they made that assumption that this was where the women sat. And we said, well, no, this is actually dedicated to Our Lady, one of the titles for the Virgin Mary. And so the Lady Chapel was always the chapel where the Virgin Mary was honoured and dedicated, usually with a statue of her. And that's what we have in St. Albans. So Our Lady Chapel is at the far eastern end of the building, and it's a beautiful chapel, added about 1320, added because, again, large numbers of pilgrims were flocking to St. Albans. And in that Lady Chapel, it had its own separate choir where pilgrims could hear services being sung and hear music. And because it was right beyond the Shrine of St. Alban, there was almost like a flow, I guess, between the Lady Chapel and the shrine itself, where pilgrims could gather and attend services.
What's it used for today?
I would call it very much the family chapel of the cathedral, because it seats about 250 people. So funerals and weddings in particular take place in that chapel, and lots of us have really strong associations with it. You know, my brother was married there, so I can remember standing there with him as his best man. It's where we say goodbye at funerals. It's also used for ecumenical services. So it's where our Roman Catholic and Russian Orthodox and German Lutheran congregations use that space too, because, as you know, St. Albans is not a building exclusively for the Church of England. We make it available to other Christians, and they very much like to use the Lady Chapel. It's a very suitable space for them.
Finally, either end of the transept completes the cross. Is there anything in either that is of significance?
Both the transepts have fantastic windows. I mean, Lord Grimthorpe, of course, put those glorious windows there, including the large round rose window, which was reglazed in the 1990 with all that glorious coloured glass. In the south transept, that's going to be your entrance into the cathedral. Once this new welcome centre that we talked about in a previous programme, when that's finished, that's going to be your entry into the building. At the moment, it's where the shop is. So if anyone knows the building now, that's the south transept. Up in the north area, there is the monument to the first bishop of St. Albans, Bishop Claughton. And there are also some monuments to Lord Grimthorpe, Archdeacon Grant, some of the significant people who saved and restored the building and repaired it in different ways in the 19th century. That space has, up till now, been used a lot as a classroom for our education people, but they will have lovely new classrooms in the revised chapter house. So we're going to explore other ways of using that space. We particularly have travelling exhibitions there. So as we speak, we have this wonderful exhibition showing the Bayeux tapestry in mosaic. It's just the most mind-blowing kind of exhibition. Imagine, you know, millions of pieces of mosaic recreating the Bayeux tapestry.
That's very long.
It's probably quarter scale, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it's fascinating. And so that north transept gets used for art displays, exhibitions, sometimes social gatherings as well. After a service, it's a good space to gather and have a cup of coffee or a glass of wine after a service. So we want to make it as functional as possible.
And one more thing, you mentioned the crypt.
There's only one crypt in the building. Only Duke Humphrey of Gloucester was allowed to have a crypt. Because St. Albans was built straight onto the hillside, and because the building was originally a recycled building of flint and bricks, if you tunneled a crypt out, you probably would have weakened the walls of the Norman Abbey. And so only one person has a crypt, and that's Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. He was allowed his own private crypt, which was hollowed out for him, and he's buried there. And in fact, you can, within the Shrine Chapel, if you sit carefully on one of the benches and look down, you can see into his crypt. We've put a light down there. His coffin is covered in his coat of arms. It's rather finely done.
You can't actually get down there and to look.
No, we let a couple of people down once a year to clean. What we found was that allowing people down there, because it's a completely enclosed space, the moisture from their breath was destroying the wall paintings. There was a glorious wall painting down there. There are now only traces of it left. You don't want that kind of damage to happen, so it's safer not to let people into that space, but they can see it.
Fantastic, Stephen. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.